We've got a show today that starts a new series on Eastern philosophy and meditation. I've discussed on past shows how we'll be discussing meditation in detail. In this show, which is called Meditation in Eastern Religion, Light, Bliss, Meditation, Ancient Flying Machines, and Nirvana Part 1 is the first series, the first show in the series, which will cover meditation in extraordinary detail. So needless to say, this is quite valuable information. This is the Antimatter Radio Show on October 1st, Thursday, 4 p.m. Eastern, live from West Lafayette, Indiana. My name is Jeffrey Grupp. The website for this show is antimatterradio.com, and then you can also go to telementation.com or abstractatom.com to get all the information you could ever want about this show. All the past shows are archived on antimatterradio.com, right in the archives link there. There's incredibly valuable information in those archives, so hopefully all of you will be able to make a point to check some of those out. I've got three books that are coming out, and a lot of this radio show has to do with those books, and there's some pretty revolutionary information, I believe, that's being covered on this show at the antimatterradio.com website, and I'm also covering it on other radio shows that I'm on from time to time as well, so we're not really messing around too much here at antimatterradio.com, trying to get the show as big as possible and as deep as possible. This show is about going into depth and into the innerness of things. You've got Americans like to stick to the surface and be quite shallow in many cases. So you've got a lot of opportunities to do that in our culture, but opportunities to go towards the depth of things are rare, and I think this show does it better than pretty much any other source I can think of. So let's talk about upcoming shows. Next week we've got a show called The New World Order Wants the New World Order to Fail. That's based on an article I published at Infowars.com on June 7th, and that's a follow-up show to a show I think 3 weeks ago it was, called The New World Order Wants 9/11 as an Inside Job Exposed. So quite a unusual thesis regarding political philosophy that I think I've got massive evidence for this thesis, and very few people are pointing it out. I've never seen anybody point it out. I'm not trying to get fame and act like I'm some smart person for thinking of this theory. I just think the word on this needs to get out. I've published basically segments of this theory on Infowars.com and RestoreTheRepublic.com, and I think a lot of people are overlooking it. It's a very critical issue to understanding the big picture of the world we're in, the political world we're in. The idea basically is that everything is controlled a lot more than most of us think. Even people that are well educated in the New World Order and the 9/11 Truth Movement and so forth do not understand how well things are controlled. The point of what's going on now is not the build up to the Orwellian system, which is what we're in now with Homeland Security and so forth. The point is the breakdown of that build up. That's what history always is based on, is the falling apart of systems, not the building up of systems. That's why so many things happen out of the outcome of World War II, for example, not the building up to World War II. I mean, the UN and the CIA and the Pentagon and Truman's Mental Health Act and so forth were not set up on the building up into World War II, but as the aftermath when the world was in shambles, in a state of destruction. So that's a very, very, very important show next week. If you're interested in political philosophy, it's a bit of a departure. I try to make this show mostly about what I'm most interested in, which is meditation, consciousness, spiritual ecstasy, and ancient history. But I'm also extremely interested and considered these days somewhat of an expert on political philosophy. There's that new Camp FEMA film, which I'm in for a little bit, and I've got my book Corporatism. So that's a big interest of mine, and I try to educate myself as much as I can on it. So that's that'll be a good show next week. October 15, we have The Nature of and Philosophy of Religion, Part 2. That follows up on last week's show, which I was very pleased with, how that went. The view of religion you're getting on this show, and shows like that last week and next week, is, I think, quite unique. It has a lot to do with biblical ufology, for example. But there's a very unique twist being given on it. I think it's a very empirical twist, describing religion as it really is. And I do not have any idea yet. Michael Tesarian is out of the country at the moment, and I've not communicated with him for a couple weeks. But We've got him tentatively scheduled late in the month, possibly on October 23. He's told me he wants to come on, so that'll be pretty interesting if we can get him on. He definitely he'd be a perfect guest for this show. So let's get into ancient Eastern religion, study of meditation, which is the subject of this show, and this will be probably a 2 or 3 part series on this topic. And really, there's no more important topic, I'd say, than meditation, for reasons I've already discussed on past shows, namely that the human in America is raised to believe that they're evolved from a monkey, and they're basically just a stupid animal, and there's nothing very special about them. So if you go to Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan or North Korea or Iran or somewhere and kill thousands of people, it's no big deal because they're just a bunch of stupid monkeys too, and nothing really matters that much. Okay, now that's funny that people say that, and or can be subconsciously tricked into thinking that is the case with theories like these pseudoscientific theories that have no evidence for them, like the monkey to man Darwinian thesis, because the theory that humans have nothing special about them is easily falsified when you just look at our spiritual nature, the size of our brain, the spiritual structure of our physical bodies, which we've discussed on past shows here, with our tantric body with its shock, with its physiological chakra system. Our enormous brains are electrical and are specifically wired for religious experience. Our consciousness is driven by an inner spiritual nature that all consciousness at the human level involves, but few people understand because they're living in what's called the egotistical shell, which is this fearful and desirous state of consciousness that covers the real self, the spiritual self. I've got a new page on my website, antimatterradio.com. If you go to the left-hand column, you'll see poetry films. And basically, these are films that I'm making for myself, but I'm, of course, putting them on my website. And they're basically what they are is they're supposed to, a lot of times when I do meditation, I try to, before I do a meditation session, I usually take about a half hour, an hour to do meditation sessions 3 times a day. I practice Soto Zen Buddhism. But when I practice my meditation, what I'll often do is flood my mind with art, some kind of art that is very moving to me, which puts me in a very euphoric state. That I've found through the years that that's a good place to start off my meditation sessions. My meditation sessions are much more productive when I do that. So what these films are, they're meant to be pieces of art that are perfect for starting off meditation sessions. So I made one last night called Inebriation of Light. And inebriation, of course, is intoxication or drunkenness or euphoria or ecstasy, some sort of euphoric drunkenness, spiritual drunkenness. And in that, basically what these films are is just poetry put to music and images. So what I consider very profound sort of filmmaking. And in this poem I wrote last night, I basically discuss how humans are actually all in love with each other and all deeply compassionate towards each other. But we don't know this because we're not living from our real selves. We're living from our states of fear and desire, our egotistical selves. That's called the false self, the disingenuous, unreal self. And in that state, we actually fear each other and hate each other in many ways, are envious and spiteful and jealous of one another. But our real inner selves, deep down, are completely in love with each other. And when I say in love, it's not a sexual issue. It's a spiritual love. I mean, well, I guess, of course, spiritual love can be sexual in many cases. But what I'm referring to is a deep sort of blissful love that all humans have towards one another. But very few people know this because so few people are living at this genuine, true inner state inner state of consciousness in our inner plane of the self, which is imbued with these feelings of love towards existence. So it's very it's just very distressing to me to see humans by the billions walking around planet Earth, living in this state of falsehood, this state of not really being human. They're actually subhuman. And, you know, I talk to people and they say, oh, war is inevitable. We're going to invade Iran now, it looks like, and or somebody is, Israel or somebody. And that's just how it goes. That's just how people are. That's history and so forth. And in this poem that you can find on antimatterradio.com, the poetry films page called Inebriation of Light, I say that actually that's not true. All humans love each other, and only people that are tricked into thinking that humans are actually spiteful towards one another and that that's normal. People have to be tricked into thinking that that's true, because it's not true. Only the false self, the scared little human, the TV-watching little human that desires all this junk from Walmart, that little scared person, yeah, that's the person that goes to war. But the true person, the person that is seeing the light of God, seeing the bliss of nirvana, that human is not a bellicose human, a warlike human. That person is, it's impossible for a person in that state to commit an act of harm towards another. It's only possible for them to commit acts of almost dumbfoundingly selfless love towards other people, other entities, other creatures. Now, there is a light and a dark side to spirituality through meditation, as I discussed on last week's show, and I'll discuss in great detail on shows in the future. And like the shamans of the ancient Yucatan, the Mayans, were, of course, imbued with a dark side of all this. Now, yeah, that does exist. Now, I don't know if that's called nirvana or a dark side of nirvana or a dark side of spirituality. It may be. But as I'll discuss on this show, the way a person is to carry out their meditation is you have to telementationally steer yourself to the light side. There is a light and dark side to meditation. And what I mean by that, I keep discussing that. What I mean by that is in your meditation, you will transform yourself, as we'll find out on these shows on Eastern philosophy and meditation. And you can go either to an extraordinarily dark direction or an extraordinarily love-filled, light-filled direction. And you have to actually, amazingly, you have to make a conscious choice of which way to go. And then when you do, you have to telementationally steer yourself in that direction. I'll discuss that in much more detail. It's hard for me to do a show like this because the average person in America does not understand anything of what we're talking about here. Like we discussed last week, the average person thinks that there's just one kind of consciousness, the ego state, and there's really nothing else. There might be, you know, some subconscious or unconscious aspects to our mental lives. But other than that, that's really it. They have no idea that just right under the surface of their ordinary state of consciousness is a happiness that is would blow them away if they knew how powerful, if they could experience how powerful it is. When you tell people this, they just laugh. They say, oh, it's almost like we think we don't deserve this, or oh, things can't be good like this. We have to have a life of hardship. It's like people are so used to this that if you say, oh, no, the actual way people are is that they love each other and we're filled with this spiritual ecstasy deep within us, you can have it that quick. And all you have to do is just do some simple meditation to get there. And when I say this, people almost get mad, like, oh, no, it can't be that way. It can't be that good for us. I say, well, why? I can prove this. I can prove this to you that this is how things are. You can see this for yourself with your own eyes. And people don't like to hear that. I think they want, I guess, this is how it works, where they want, they've been taught the world is a certain way when they were young. And that's basically where we live in a life of hardship and jobs that we don't like and lying governments and war and death and misery and disease and no cures for cancer and all this kind of stuff. I guess people are taught that, and in a sense it's what they're taught. They want to believe it. It's almost like people will die in some cases to continue believing a certain way rather than just change their view and not die and live a happier life. for example, I have someone in my family that I'm very close to that has MS. And when they were diagnosed with MS, I just said, well, that's just aspartame poisoning. You know, MS is a new epidemic, which started the same year, 1984, that aspartame, the chemical sweetener in thousands of foods, became legal. And it existed before that because of other kinds of food additives and so forth that caused it. But it really didn't exist before the food additives, and it really got going when aspartame came legal in 1984. And there's all kinds of cases where people reverse their MS. They just change their diet, and it takes a while, a lot of detoxification of the body and so forth. But you can reverse MS, which is a neurological disorder. And this person in my family will not they actually get angry at me for saying that. And here, let me add to this story. This is a pretty interesting story, actually. When I first told them that, they were in a state of shock because it was right after they were diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis. And they were sort of in an open mental state because they were so in shock. That diagnosis jarred them from their typical state of thinking and so forth. So when I first told them, oh, it's aspartame poisoning, because I knew this person, they drink, you know, 10 cans of Diet Coke a day and so forth, which is, you know, anybody who does that is a good candidate for multiple sclerosis. So I told them this, and they instantly believed me. I couldn't believe it. They said, oh, okay, I'll cut out all the aspartame. And I said, well, you really have to cut out a lot. You have to be careful because a lot of times they'll put, you know, natural flavor or something on a food and not really tell you there's aspartame in it. They'll just say it's natural flavoring or artificial flavoring or something. And so anyway, this person did cut out, they cut Diet Coke and cut out a whole bunch of other foods. Probably they did not cut all the aspartame. But what happened is they experienced a marked improvement immediately. And it improved through time as well. There was an immediate improvement, and then it kept getting larger and larger. But then all of a sudden, this person turned on me and said, no, they denied that all happened. They said, oh, no, there was no improvement. I thought there was, but I was mistaken somehow. There really was an improvement. It was not an improvement. And it's not aspartame poisoning. It's just a problem with my body, and I don't want to hear any more of your opinions. Thanks, go away. So basically, they went to the doctor, and the doctor just tells them, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do. Here's some medicine to alleviate the symptoms a little, and the medicine's very dangerous. It has lots of side effects. Thanks. $100, please. So that's what they tell them at the doctor. No results, no predictions, no cures, no nothing. And I give them something real, something that makes sense, that they get immediate results from, and they reject that. And this is just interesting because what does it show us? It shows that if the mass of humanity believes a certain way, the rest of humanity, individuals in the group will follow that mass psychosis, that mass paradigm of the group, no matter what. No matter if their eyes tell them something different is true, or if they're going to die if they keep holding on to these beliefs or what, they will still believe it because humans are made to be conformist. They're made to follow the group. It's almost suspicious. A lot of these people, like we discussed last week, how in their world religions, we're basically told that extraterrestrial-like creatures from the sky came and created humans. That's what all the religions involve. And then there's these other creation stories, like Genesis 6 has one, where we find out, there might have been a dark race, fallen angels, Nephilim, the Nephilim, or something that tampered with the spiritual creation of humans at a later time. In Genesis 6, it says that the fallen angels, or the Nephilim, sometimes referred to as giants, they're apparently non-human or something. They came to Earth or were on Earth or something and reproduced with the humans as if they're different than the giants or the fallen angels to create the world leaders. That is in Genesis 6, 1 through 6. It's just really amazing. I mean, that confirms, if you think the Bible is true, that confirms what all the conspiracy theorists have been talking about, which is that there's something dark and unhuman and almost satanic about the New World Order elite. It's very stunning, very, very amazing issue right there. Anyway, let's get back to the point here. It's during this time of tampering, it's almost as if humans could have been created to be slave-like. When there's no better way to make slaves than to create them to be utterly conformist. That means you can just get world leaders and so, and other people, rock stars and so forth, to exemplify certain ideologies, and the sheep of the human race will follow along no matter what. I mean, you can have the anti-war President Obama get up on TV and say, elect me, I'll end the wars. And then he gets in office, and he starts a new war in Pakistan, increases the troops in Afghanistan, increases the troops in Iraq, and threatens Iran. And people will say, we love Obama. So that tells it right there. It's very stunning. Something fishy and peculiar about it. We have these huge brains, but we cannot think apart from the group. It's very interesting things to learn from here. I don't have any answers. I'm just asking questions here. Questions that not a lot of people are asking because people are very busy just believing what the group says. So when you ask questions like this, I get a lot of hate mail and a lot of angry comments on YouTube from some of my videos that are put there about how I'm such a horrible person because I'm asking questions. And it, when you're in a time of tyranny, asking questions becomes a crime, something you can be tasered and shot and killed for. Okay, when I say tasered, I don't mean to attack police because I published an article this week, actually 2 days ago on RestoreTheRepublic.com, discussing how much I like police and how I think they're wonderful. And the police that we saw in Pittsburgh, those actually weren't even police. Those were that's Blackwater. That's posing as police. That's a paramilitary force. Those police weren't the Pittsburgh police. They were shipped in from all over the country. And the police that I know are like Mike Fisher, my police chief here in West Lafayette, Indiana. Wonderful person. And I've never really seen bad police in my life with my own eyes. I see them on TV. And the media sensationalizes stories of taserings and stuff. You know, these very obscure stories. But the overall, the police are not our enemy. They're with us. The enemy is whatever Genesis 6, 1 through 6 is talking about. Very profound information. So let me get to Eastern philosophy. I'm not even getting to this here yet. Okay, so Eastern philosophy is composed of Hinduism, Buddhism, and some Islam, some shamanism. But mainly we're going to be concerned with Hinduism and Buddhism. Now, Hinduism and Buddhism are very different from... Well, here's the way I used to describe it to students. I would say, take everything that is a mainstream idea in your life that you've learned through your culture and invert it. Turn it into its opposite. And when you do that, you've got Eastern philosophy. You've got Buddhism and Hinduism. Let's go through some examples. Well, I've got so many examples here that I could go through. Let me just think of some off the top of my head. Let's just take mental illness. In American culture, we find that when you don't fit into the group, it's called mental illness. For example, when you exhibit behavior that is antisocial or you can't sit still in your classroom when you're in sixth grade like the rest of your classmates can sit still. These are behaviors that are against the group and are warranted as mental illness. Okay, even though they're very common. Okay, I mean, how many kids can't sit still? Half the boys in the class, for example. That's why Ritalin use is so common, because it's actually just a natural behavior. I mean, what kid can sit still in a class? Okay. So anyway, we find that if a person can't fit into culture very well, where culture is defined largely by the television and so forth, for example, if they tell us on TV we need to go to war, people believe it and they send their kids to war. Okay, so that's how culture is created by TV. I mean, it's so strong, that creation is so strong that we'll even sacrifice our children for it. So, in Eastern philosophy, the exact opposite position is held. It is not held that if you don't fit into culture, you need to change yourself to fit the culture. And if you have to, take dangerous drugs like Prozac and so forth to change your brain structure to make you fit in, to robotize you, robotize you, turn you into a robot. That's the Western view. That's the American, or sorry, not the Western view. That's the modern American view. Okay, the Eastern view is exactly the opposite. They say you're not supposed to fit into culture because culture is sick. Okay, culture is a disease, and you need to escape from it. So, okay, see how that's exactly the opposite? From East to West, or East to modern America. Modern America culture is thought to be correct, and if you don't fit into it, you need Prozac. So when you have a little child, sixth grader, who can't sit still in the class, and he goes to see the school psychologist, the school psychologist won't say, "Little Johnny, I can understand why you can't sit still in your class, because that's not the kind of environment that's made for you. You're made for going out and running around on a playground. You're made for exploring dirt and worms and planting seeds and doing things hands-on. You're not designed to sit in a chair for an hour without moving. So therefore, you don't need to change. The culture needs to change to accommodate you." No, that's not what happens. What happens is he's called bad. He's told he has a problem, and he needs to change to fit the culture, and the culture is not questioned. Okay, exactly the opposite of Eastern philosophy, where the culture is always condemned, not just questioned, but condemned, and the inner spiritual autonomy and freedom of the infinite light of the human person, of the spirit, of the self, is always considered perfect. Okay? See how incredibly different these philosophies are from one another? So, there's many examples of how we'll go through many of them on the series. But that's just a good introductory example to think of how modern American culture is the inverse of Eastern philosophy. Now, modern American culture is, a lot of people in modern American culture are very animositous towards Eastern philosophy. I've heard Christians call Buddhism Satanism. Well, let me just put it this way. I've been a very engaged Buddhist since 1992, when I was 22 years old. Now I'm 39. Okay, I've published a book on Buddhism. I'm a political activist. I've been on the Alex Jones show, Dr. Deagle's show. I've got 3 books coming out, and I've been a college teacher for 8 years. And I think that qualifies me of not being engaged in something as hideous as Satanism. And I will also tell you, Buddhism has given me nothing but profundity, happiness, satisfaction, feelings of love for my fellow humans. And I see those same Christians calling Buddhism Satanism filled with hate. Hate towards Iran. Hate towards Iraq, because they watch TV and hear it. They want these people dead. They turn their eye to children being slaughtered in Iraq. Yeah, where's the Satanism lie? Okay, Buddhism is passive, filled with love, compassion towards all people. That's all it's done for me. If I didn't have Buddhism, I would be lost. Okay, so, yeah, I'll give you, Buddhism is strange. Okay, it's strange because from our perspective growing up in American culture, everything we're told that is good, Buddhism says is bad, basically. So, yeah, it takes some digesting to get used to Buddhism. It's quite a shock when you study it. Okay, so, yeah, it can be shocking, but to say that it's evil or satanic, you are totally ignorant when you say that. You have not engaged in it. It's given me a love for all things that is ineffable. I can't even put it into words, in other words. So anyway, let's get into this a little bit here. Now, the modern American has trouble understanding the concepts of Buddhism, such as its anti-Eastern religion, which are as follows. The Hindu and the Buddhist will tell you that the forms and structures of matter that you see all around you either do not exist or are not fully real. And what is fully real and what does actually exist is something that goes by many names, but I can summarize what it is in general if I say it's some sort of infinite sea of light. And in that infinite sea of light is contained yourself and infinite happiness. a happiness so deep that few of you have any idea what is really involved in it. So that's difficult for the average person to believe, because when they look around with their eyes, their physical eyes, they see matter, and they have no reason to think it's not real, because they've never seen anything but that. So therefore, they accept it as being real and all there is. And if you die and go to heaven, it's just going to be more matter, just somewhere else in some other heavenly domain. Okay? Now, interestingly, our quantum physicists, since the 1920s, have discovered that if you take apart reality down to its smallest levels that we can study, you find out that it is made of something like an infinite energy, or a super energy or light, everywhere. That's all we find. And it does not obey the laws of matter, and therefore it is not material. It does not have time and space and motion and magnitude and solidity and material items and stuff like our material realm has. So therefore, the quantum domain has to be considered non-material, very metaphysical, spiritual, or some kind of domain, because it does not obey material laws. So I get castigated every time I say so, but isn't that a huge verification for Eastern religion? I remember when I was at Western Michigan University as a graduate student studying comparative philosophy, and I had a class with, what's the name of that professor? He studies Japanese religion, philosophy. I'll try to look him up here as we're going. I'll never remember. It'll take me too long to look up. I'm not going to look it up right now. Cover, Professor Cover. Very nice person, but when I told him that, I just said in passing to him one time, I said, hey, I think Cover. I can't remember his name. I said, I think that quantum physics seems to verify the Eastern philosophies. And he was so angry at me for saying that, because he said, no, you can't do that. I said, why? And basically what he said was, well, because that's science. And religion is just some belief, cultural beliefs people have. And I said, wait, how do you say that? That's a huge assumption. How do you say that? And you have to understand that when you're in academia, you can't challenge a professor too much. I couldn't really press him on that and say, give me the answer. What are you talking about? These are assumptions. Let's debate this. Let's get to the meat and bones of it. This is interesting. Let's grind into this issue. You can't really do that in academia because, well, it's difficult for people to understand if they're not in academia, but they're supposed to be the authority, and I'm supposed to not know more than them, and they're supposed to tell me what's going on, and they're not supposed to make mistakes, as if humans don't make mistakes. So that was, as I said last week, I dropped out of that program. It was not the right program for me. Wonderful, nice people, but I was looking for the metaphysics of it all. So anyway, the point here is that the average American has to even though quantum physics tells us that reality is composed of a sea of light, and our meditation experience can, and I think we all suspect that this is the case deep down in us. I think we all suspect that this material world we see is not totally there. There's something funny about it. Okay, it's like a dream. Okay, you can find the most stodgy fundamentalist Christian and press them, say, do you think all this stuff, like this wood desk here in front of me, is actually real? Do you suspect there's something bigger behind it, something grander, something more powerful, more spiritual to it all? And they're going to say, yeah, you know, deep down, I feel it. There's something bigger to it all than what my feeble little pathetic senses are telling me is real about the world. And I say, bam, that's it, right there. We've all got this spark inside of us, and it's easy to get out. It's just we have to turn off the stupid TV. We have to get out of these wars, and we have to get to our real nature, which is, our real nature is called freedom, and it's called love. Okay. So, but anyways, the average person has a difficult time getting to that point. Okay, it doesn't matter that their sense world has deceived them. thousands and thousands of times. And every day they notice that their sense world is filled with error. It's still all they think they know, so they follow it. But Eastern religion, Eastern philosophy, is all about denigrating the world of the senses, castigating it as being incorrect, a domain of pain and misery, where the inner superconsciousness is a domain of freedom and happiness. Okay? So, in this discussion on Eastern philosophy, I wanted to refer to two kinds of people. There's, on the one hand, what we'll call the natural person. Okay, and I've used that term following the French philosopher Hubert Benoit, who wrote a book called Zen and the Psychology of Transformation, which is one of my favorite books I've ever read, probably my number one favorite book I've ever read. And in that book, he discusses what he calls the natural person. And that's basically just the egotistical person, the person who's pushed around by the forces of nature, helplessly, believing that they don't create their own reality. Reality is created for them. And they're controlled by their desires and their fears, and they don't know much of anything. And they go about their life working day to day and don't make much of a fuss about anything. They go to work, come home, watch TV, kick the dog around a little, go to sleep. And then they turn on the TV in the morning and get all mad about the Iranians and Afghans and all these people they've never met. Go to work and then do it all over again. That's the natural person. Now, the key to the natural person is they are people who are not aware of actual reality. They are aware of only the material domain, not the actual domain, the spiritual domain, the spiritual self. So that means that the mass of humanity on planet Earth are what we're calling the natural person, or the natural persons. Okay. Now, according to the natural person, the natural person is a person who operates according to common sense. Okay. They think common sense is what reality is. So common sense is whatever culture tells you is what everybody thinks. And that's what really exists. So the natural persons have a belief that common sense equals reality, and therefore they believe what they're told rather than what they experience with their senses and what they experience with their inner experience. Okay? So to have this sort of an ideology, a natural person must only focus their attention outwardly. Okay, then I cannot focus their attention inwardly. Okay? In other words, they can't go and sit in a closet in the evening and shut their eyes, turn off the lights, put in earplugs, and block out their sense experience of the world in order to focus on their inner mental content. To do that would be to look inward. Okay, what they do is not that. They always are looking outward. They're looking outward at the TV. They're looking outward at the newspaper. They're looking outward at whatever they're doing at their job. They're always looking out. They're never focused inward. They may be scared of the inner, believe it or not. I've had people tell me, no, I don't want to do meditation. I don't want to look inside me. It's too scary. I don't want to take the psilocybin mushroom because it's too scary what's in it. I say, too scary? I said, that's you that's in there. What are you scared of? The world you should be scared of, not that. You is where the beauty, the spirituality is. So what they're doing is they're specifically taking their apparatus of perception, they're looking, their mind's eye, their awareness, and using it to focus outward on the material only, not on the innerness, the real. Okay? So in order to be a natural person, you have to do that. You have to focus your consciousness externally, at the exterior aspects of reality, which are what we're calling the either not real or less than real. Okay, so the natural person, in other words, is in their only looking outward. They are therefore only focusing on matter and believe that it's all that there is. So the natural person is associated with materialism, with matter. Okay, the two philosophies go together. So all this goes together. The natural person goes with materialism, and it goes with fear and desire, the egotistical consciousness, which goes with feelings of misery and loss and hate and war. Do you see how it's really, really bad if we have a despiritualized culture, which is not a meditative or meditational culture, carrying out meditation practice? You know, instructed by people, parents instructing it to kids when they're young, learning how to do this. You see how a culture can become completely lost. I mean, if you're never looking inside yourself, you're always looking out at the world, you never know yourself. You know of nothing. You have no idea what your feelings are, your thoughts, what you really want. You may be in a relationship that you hate, and it may take you years, and all of a sudden one day you'll say, wow, I hate this relationship. I want out. And why didn't I realize that? I felt this way for 5 years. The answer to that is because you're not looking in at the self. You're only looking out at the exterior, the material. So therefore, you have no clue of what you really want, what you really are. So this is actually practical. Being an inwardist person is actually a practical task. You have a better life in this simple example I'm giving. Okay, so the opposite scenario here is the person who partially or fully extends their awareness inwardly. We'll discuss that in just a minute. Now let me give you a quote here from a book by Alan Watts called The Wisdom of Insecurity, page 121. This is not Alan Watt, who you often hear on Infowars.com and Dr. Deagle's show. This is a different Alan Watts with an S. He was a Buddhist philosopher who is dead now, who became very popular in the 50s and 60s, writing about Zen Buddhism. And here's page 121 of his book, Wisdom of Insecurity. The natural man lives for one motive, to protect his body from pain and to associate it with pleasure. Because he can only feel with his own body, he has little interest in the feelings of other bodies. Therefore, he will only take interest in other bodies under the stimulus of rewards and punishments, that is, by an exploitation of his self-interest and the interests of the community. So it's a very accurate and profound quote. It's basically saying, well, it's saying so much I can almost do a two-hour show just on this. But what basically it's one thing it's saying is, as we'll find in meditation, when you don't just focus on the exterior and you actually start to focus on the self, you start to get a grasp of what feelings are and that feelings exist and that consciousness has power. And there are other creatures out there that not only have these feelings and consciousness and power, but it's not separate from you. You find their feelings inside you, and your thoughts are inside them, and you two are not separate. This is how compassion is formed. Okay, so that's why the natural person's world is filled with war, selfishness, and hate, and people treating each other quite dreadfully, to say the least. The inwardist person, the meditative, the spiritualized person, will have less of that if they're actually doing that spiritual practice. Okay, a lot of people just talk about, oh yeah, I want to, you know, Buddhism sounds cool, I want to get into it. But I've known very few people who have actually really done the work of doing it. See, that's because people don't understand how happy you become when you carry out this meditation practice. We think with these false or shallow senses of happiness, such as when we watch TV or have a six-pack or do something, some other thing, watch basketball. We think these shallow levels of happiness are, we just flee to them because we want to escape the opposite, which is states of unhappiness. So therefore, we have no idea that there's a huge state of happiness waiting inside of us, that if we just tasted it once, we would instantly become addicted and want to get back to that state. So let's move on here. Let me discuss the mind's eye. I need to discuss a few terms here before we go on. to discuss the natural person and meditation in more detail. So the natural person is basically just the Eastern philosophy take on what a human is. A human who has, to put it in the way Japanese Buddhists do, who has forgotten their inner spiritual nature. Okay, in other words, it's covered by fear and desire. It's covered by ego. Okay, so let's go through a few terms here. What is called the mind's eye is what you can call awareness. And basically what it is there's a piece of your consciousness that's like an eye or a lens or something. I don't think this is a physical eye or lens because I don't think consciousness is physical for reasons I've discussed several times on past shows, such as there's no evidence that it's physical. So it's an eye or a lens that looks at other pieces of consciousness. Okay, in other words, if you see a yellow school bus, there's a yellow image constructed in your consciousness. And that's what you're seeing. You're actually seeing the yellow image that you're constructing consciousness. You're actually seeing the real yellowness of the bus. Because what happens is that yellowness of the bus is just light reflected off the bus that enters your eyes, that gets processed in your brain, and then inside your brain is somehow consciousness is constructing images of yellowness. And that's what you're seeing. So, but there's something looking at the yellowness inside your consciousness. So there has to be two aspects of consciousness. There's the thing that's looking, and there's what it's looking at. So the thing that's doing the looking is what we call the mind's eye. And it may be the case that the mind's eye is the self. It's what you are. Okay, and all your life is consisted of is your inner mind's eye looking at other aspects of consciousness. Okay, now some of you might be like, no, this doesn't make sense. When I look at the, I've got an aloe plant here in my office. When I look at the aloe plant, it seems like the aloe plant is over there and I'm over here. Now, it may seem that way, but your thinking and your thought about the aloe plant, your perceiving of it, is going on inside your brain and consciousness. So the perception and the action of perception is happening inside your head. So it may seem like that aloe is over there and the aloe plant, the experience, is of something out there, but it may be. But the experiencing itself is inside your consciousness and your brain and head. So therefore, whether or not the aloe plant is out there or not is irrelevant. Because your experiencing is always inner. The only thing you have ever known in your life is innerness. The exterior does not exist as far as you know. It's an assumption, and it's a figment of your imagination. Now, it may be real. It may be an assumption based on reality. It may be that your consciousness, your inner states of consciousness, are mapping real states of the world. But you don't know that. And you can't prove that there's any outerness. You only can prove that there's this innerness. How do you prove there's this innerness? Well, you witness it directly right now. I see an aloe plant. I see green, long, beautiful stems. And therefore, I have pieces of consciousness. And you can't go any deeper than that. That's absolute proof. So what do I have proof? I have proof that I have images of an aloe plant in my consciousness. I do not have proof that there's an aloe plant. Because I could be dreaming. The greenness might not really be there. A lot of physicists say that color really doesn't exist. It's just our brain's way of processing information about the light entering our eyes and so forth. So this is all very philosophical and all very profound. I suggest if some of you are not following me to go back and listen to this again in the archives, because this is very... it's quite profound, a lot of this. And a lot of how sure we were of ourselves, a lot of our assuredness goes away. And some people think, oh, that's horrible. We need to be so sure of ourselves. And you know what my answer to that is? No, we don't. We need to be humble. We need to chill out. Okay, it's the confident and the assured people that go out and start wars. It's the people that are questioning, the people that are thinking, the people that are contemplating, meditating, wondering about it all, who stop and look and listen. Okay? It's the reactive fools who say, no, we need to have confidence and go do something. No, I say there's nothing we need to do except develop our spirituality, and then everything will fall into place. We'll have greater technologies for reasons we've discussed in past shows, greater lives, greater families, deeper love, more happiness, no war, and so forth. If we just, like, for example, go listen to that Walter Cruttenden show in the archives, if you're not familiar with what I'm talking about. I think that was the show from July. So those are the inner aspects of consciousness. Now, the inner aspects of consciousness, where you have a mind's eye or awareness looking at other aspects of consciousness, these images keep shifting. For example, my cat is sitting here right on my desk in front of me. Now I'm looking at my cat. Now I'm looking at the aloe plant again. So the images shift. Cat, aloe, cat, aloe. Okay? So it seems to me that these are real. And they may be. But again, it's only inside my consciousness. Now, there's two, that's what consciousness is. The mind's eye looking at other images. Now, there's two ways to think about consciousness. And that's with the inner aspects of consciousness and the outer aspects of consciousness. And this is where meditation, we start talking about meditation. This gets very profound right here. Very interesting, mysterious, and meditation comes into the picture right now. Let me start talking about this. Let's first talk about the outer. Basically, here, the summary of it is this. As your mind's eye looks at other images in your consciousness, some of the images you believe to be outer, and some of the images that your consciousness looks at you believe to be inner. So, for example, if I open my eyes and stare at my aloe plant, I believe those are images of the exterior, of the outer, of the material. Now, if I look and think about and contemplate and stare at my aloe plant long enough, it doesn't feel very material. It feels like the aloe plant itself is a spiritual force, if you know enough about plants and life and the medicinal qualities of an aloe plant and electrical qualities to life and plants and plant biocommunication and all this kind of stuff. But I'm just going from the average common person's perspective, they're going to think that the aloe is material just like this plastic phone here is material. And those are going to be images we believe are outer. Okay? And then on the other hand, if I close my eyes and if I look and see what feeling I have inside of me, right now I have a feeling of sort of elation, excitement, and anticipation for something big. It's just this buzzing feeling inside me. Okay, some of you may have feelings inside you of sadness right now. Some of you may have feelings inside you of boredom or happiness or hate or love. Whatever it is, all of you have a feeling buzzing inside of you right now. Okay, so if I close my eyes and feel that feeling in me, I think that that's inner. Or if I, let's say in my mind, I conjure up an image of a blue dragon. Okay, I'm thinking of it right now. There's the blue dragon. It's floating and flying through the sky. Okay, now that image I believe is inner. Okay, so some of my images I believe are outer. Some of my images I believe are inner. Okay, now here's the mysterious thing. And man, I've been thinking about this for years, and I just can't. There's something big to what I'm about to say. Something huge. I can't quite get my mind around what it is. There's something, some big hint to our existence involved here. It almost has to do with the splice theory we discussed on last week's show about world religions, nature religion, part one. And it's this is what I'm referring to. Here it goes. If we focus our attention on the outer aspects of consciousness, we become egotistical human beings, people living in the domain of ego. And therefore, we think matter is real. Material entities are the only things that exist. We become filled with fear and desire. We become bellicose, warlike, in other words. We become filled with hate, jealousy, envy, and shallowness, desperation. As Thoreau said, all men lead lives of quiet desperation. in Walden. Just by focusing our attention on the outer aspects of consciousness, that's what happens. And it seems to me in almost every case. Of course, there's probably exceptions. Now, what happens if we focus our attention on the inner aspects of consciousness? The exact opposite happens. In other words, if we focus our mind's eye on the inner images, feeling and that, you know, thoughts and so forth, mental inner visualizations, like the blue dragon that I just discussed. For some reason, if we do that enough, the exact opposite state emerges in us, and that's a state of bliss, ecstasy, love, freedom, anti-fatalism, spiritual joy, and a belief, and then really a realization, a direct witnessing of the fact that matter is not real. Or its best case scenario is it's partially real, and what is real is the sea of energy that is everywhere. And inside it is somehow this incredible, godly, heavenly happiness. Okay, so do you understand then that meditation, what it consists of, is looking inward, taking your mind's eye and simply looking at the inner aspects of consciousness, the inner imagery, and shutting out to some degree, either fully or partially, or maybe take sections of a day where you shut out the outer aspects of consciousness. You close your eyes and look at the inner. Feel your feelings. Look at your thoughts and visualizations. Think about your thoughts, in other words. Okay, now, this is very mysterious. Why should it matter if my mind's eye is looking at this one set of images, the outer images, or this other set of images, the inner images? Because aren't they both just all mental in the mind? But for some reason, the difference between the two makes all the difference in the world, between our happiness or our misery, our life being filled with love and spiritual realization, or being filled with ignorance and hate. So this is a very serious show, to say the least, very serious topic. There's no messing around here, okay? I mean, everybody thinks that, you know, serious issues are engineering and Fox News. I don't think so. Okay, those are the egotistical domain. Those are the outer aspects of consciousness. They will bring you war and hate. Okay, and that's why people who go into engineering are building bombs. They're building TVs that we can watch pornography on and you know, 16,000 episodes of the Brady Bunch. All this junk. Our big brains are not meant for that. Our big brains are some kind of spiritual portal, or we call it on past shows a receptacle of some sort, some instrument, which is meant to have communication with this massive force that is everywhere. Okay? So somehow, that's what the brain is. Our human brain, I have no idea about animals, maybe to some degree, I'm not sure, because I have to experience an animal's reality to know. But the brain is some sort of machine or spiritual technology meant for understanding this drunken God force everywhere. So let me just review this. Your inner aspects of, your outer aspects of consciousness, that is, are experiences you have that you think are outside of you, separated from you, at a distance from you. You think they're separate and distinct from your consciousness or your body. So for example, if you see a frog in the morning, in a pond in the sunlight, sitting on the lily pad, you may be inclined to think, oh, the frog is there and I'm here. And the two of us are separate and distinct, not identical. There are different locations, different places, they have different properties. And we are not one, we are two. So as obvious as that may seem, the Eastern philosophers say, not only do we say that that's false, we can prove it in two ways. We can prove it through logic, and we can prove it through meditation. Because logic will... Man, that's a big subject right there. But logic actually does not work in that case as well. Let me explain a little what I mean about that a second. We've discussed this a little bit on past shows, but if you logically discuss and analyze the material physical realm, it will fall apart. You will logically and analytically analyze it to such a degree that it makes no sense anymore. For example, try to describe motion. Try to describe time. Try to describe the solidity of this piece of wood right here that composes my desk. Try to describe feeling. What are the most basic aspects of our consciousness? Time, space. Try to describe space. Try to describe velocity. And if you try to define these things, you always define a contradiction. Now, contradictions are impossible. They can't exist. You can't. A contradiction is the square is round. Okay, the square can't be round. That's an impossible state of affairs. It does not exist. Okay, if you try to describe motion, for example, as we've discussed on past shows, what you're describing is something at a set of still states moving from point A to B. It's at one state and another state and another position, another position, another position. At all these positions between point A it's going to and its destination point B. But at each destination point, it's perfectly still. Such as if you take time-lapse photography of a bullet, if you have a quick enough camera, it'll take a picture for you of a still bullet and its trajectory from A to B. So the motion is still. It's moving stillness. That's a contradiction. That's what motion is. A set of still states that comprise a moving item. See, that's a very serious philosophical issue. And so just our basic logic shows us that our physical domain is, there's some serious trouble with it, okay? So anyway, I've discussed that before. There's a video on antimatterradio.com, left-hand column called UCLA Video, I think it's called, where years ago when I was really into my academic work, I went to UCLA and gave a talk on this very topic. And so if you want to know more, you can go check that video out. So that's the outer aspects of consciousness. The inner aspects of consciousness are experiences you have of things out that you think are inside of you, are not separated from you, not at a distance from you, from yourself or your body. So this is all the opposite of the outer aspects of consciousness. Okay, so when you see a feeling come into your mind, for example, you may be inclined to think that your thoughts and your feelings and your mind's eye are all located in the same place, right where you are. And thus, all these things are not distinct from you. Obviously, since they're associated with one another, and for all you can tell, are in the exact same place. So those are the inner aspects of consciousness. Many Eastern philosophers, for the many reasons I've already given here in this show today, think that those are the only things that exist, actually. Okay. That's what many Eastern philosophers have said for hundreds of years. Now, one thing I want to say before we go on is, when we were talking earlier about how reality is made of light, I'd like to also share that the Western religions hold the same position. Okay? There is really no distinction between Eastern and Western religion. I know that, you know, when I make a statement like that, obviously it's going to be controversial, and obviously somebody out there is going to get mad at that. I don't mean to be offensive. I'm just trying to state the obvious. Because when you have Saul on the road to Damascus collapsing to the ground in a vision of God in the form of light, so God there in that case is light, well, that's just the same thing that Hinduism and Buddhism say. They say there's an ultimate spiritual power that gives us religious ecstasy when we mentally contact it. And it's like the height of divinity, and it's light. So that's exactly the same thing as Saul on the road to Damascus. Okay, so I know there's this great need we all have to say, oh, my religion's right and yours is wrong, and I'm going to heaven and you're going to hell, and you're bad and I'm good. We all want to do that, but we all want our religious book to show that we're right, and oh, just coincidentally somehow all these other people are wrong and they're going to hell. All that doesn't really work if you actually read the religious texts, because they all say the exact same thing. like I was discussing a little bit last week. So really that's just more what that really is when we all gang up on each other and try to create wars over our religions and our economics and resources and all the things that make us go to war. Usually we're tricked into going to war by the government forces. But really all that is fear and desire. It's the egotistical consciousness in action, because the true inner self of the human, which almost none of us even know anything about, it's impossible for them to do that kind of activity. So it's very foreign what I'm talking about to what most people know, because most people have been trained to think that, no, humans aren't like that. Humans are stupid and warlike and hateful. So war is natural and inevitable, and poverty is okay, and all the world that we have is as good as we're going to get, how it should be. That is false, and more false. The world that you have is the product of sick culture, New World Order culture, a culture ruled by big governments, militaries, and religions that have been hijacked by fools and idiots, like the Dalai Lama, like Pat Robertson, and all these morons that run these religions, who are really just cult political heroes for TV, okay? Yeah, I know I'm supposed to say the Dalai Lama is so great and everything, and my students always wanted to be when I was teaching the university, and I really wouldn't say anything. But so I said it here for the first time. That guy's just a phony, just like all the other religious leaders in the world. The real religious leaders are people like Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King, people like that. Those were the people who are really were reading the religious texts, doing the religious meditation, carrying out the work, and living spiritual lives. Okay, and you can see what the system did to those people, just like what it did to Jesus. I have all these people on my YouTube videos commented about how, oh, you can't say that government's bad, blah, 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 and then they'll say that in one paragraph, and then the next paragraph they'll start talking about how the only way to know anything is through Jesus and all this. And then I'll say to them, well, you're simply not noticing the fact that big government killed Jesus. So you want to sit here and stand up for both of them and tell me they're both great, when big government's responsible for war and half the misery in our lives. And that, so you want to talk about Jesus too. Well, who killed Jesus? Big government. Let's put two and two together, everybody, okay? Let's not be so filled with unthinkingness that we can't even notice a simple contradiction. All right. I mean, we've got big brains. Let's turn off the TV and figure some things out, okay? Because we've got serious problems in the world today. We've got an economic collapse that's looming. We've got, I mean, it's October 1, 2009. We're talking any day this thing is going to go. It's been teetering for some time and almost collapsed a year ago. But it's getting serious. We're on the verge of war. We're on the verge of food holocaust, where genetically modified food is going to destroy the crops of the world. We're at a historic global shift. One of those times that in 1,000 years, people will read the history books and say, wow, I can't imagine what they were going through. That we're right at the tip of that happening now. And we're sitting here screwing around trying to talk about how, oh, is the government good or bad? Or, should we tell the Jews they're going to hell? Or should we tell the Islamists and are the Christians bad or are the Buddhists good? I mean, this is ridiculous. Let's get a clue, okay? The religions are not telling different stories, and there's no differences between humans other than some minor physiological differences. We all have the same drives towards family, love, peace, getting adequate food supply, being healthy, having some enjoyment, getting satisfactory in spiritual work, having enough sufficient wealth, and so forth. There aren't differences in those sets of scenarios. The only differences between us are insignificant. Like, Sally has black hair and Reggie has red hair. Who cares? Okay? But of course, the TV, that's all I talk about. Talk about all this racism stuff, which, as I've discussed on past shows, I don't even think exists. If it did, I'd know some white people in my life. In my 39 years of living, I'd know more than one person who genuinely didn't like blacks. But unfortunately, of all the white people I've known, I've only known one person who has even exemplified anything like that. So anyway, difference. Let's move on here. Okay, so that's a very profound issue about our inner and outer aspects of consciousness. Now, so let me say a couple more things about that. The Eastern philosophers also hold that if your mind's eye is looking at the outer aspects of consciousness, those are sort of like a dream state. Okay, so again, this is the opposite of what the typical American thinks. As I said at the very beginning of this show, Eastern philosophy is the opposite of modern contemporary American thought. Take everything a modern contemporary American thinks and flip it on its head, that's Eastern philosophy. So in Eastern philosophy, in modern America, we think, oh, the inner world is dreams and imagination and not really real. In the outer world of material, that's the real stuff. Okay, Eastern philosophy holds the exact opposite. The inner aspects of our lives are where we find realness, things that actually exist. And the outer aspects, the domain of the material, there's the dream world. Okay? And I've pointed out reasons already why they think so, but really to understand exactly why they hold that, you have to carry out meditation. You have to do it, see what it's all about. And you'll have direct awareness of these things. There won't be ideas that somebody told you. You will see this with your own eyes, and you'll know it to be true. Just how, you know, when you see something green and you say, ah, I know that that thing is green. That's what will happen to you. You know, there's just things that you just know and you can't explain. Well, there's certain things that you just come to know when you're carrying out meditation. You don't need to explain them. You just know them to be true. Okay, so here's another issue. When you focus on the outer aspects of consciousness, the mind's eye expands. If you look at the outer aspects of consciousness, the mind's eye shrinks. Okay, so the outer-oriented images of your consciousness cause the mind's eye to get small. Okay, so a small, shrinking mind's eye. Remember, we called the mind's eye the self earlier. I think that that's the self. Okay, a small, shrinking mind's eye is associated with war and hate and fear, materialism, and exteriority. Okay, when you focus on the inner aspects of consciousness, your mind's eye expands. It can expand so much that it can become the size of the universe or of reality. Okay. So that means the self would expand. Self is not bound by the body. The self can expand greatly beyond the body. The self, for most of us, is already larger than the body. We just don't know how to see that. Okay, very interesting issues, very metaphysical, yet verifiable. Verifiable means you can see it with your experience, and these are all things we can see with our experience. Okay, so some of you might wonder, is any of this scientific, since I'm getting onto that issue? Well, it doesn't really matter, because we're talking on a level of existence sort of above and beyond the scientific. Okay. But I know some of you want to hear and answer that question, so I will discuss this just for a second. Now, it does seem that everything I'm discussing here by Eastern religion is verified by science. Let's just take an example. Here we go. We've said that the greenness of, I just said, if you see something green, you tend to think it's real. And your exterior-oriented natural person state of ego consciousness. Okay, but we'll say I'm looking at a leaf that's green. So what if I said, I'm going to be like a scientist, and I'm going to try to really find out what this greenness is. What is the green? So you take the leaf off the tree, you dissect it, and you put it under a microscope. You try to look deep into the leaf and find out what is the greenness. What is this green stuff? Okay? And guess what happens when you magnify that leaf? You find out the leaf is not green. The leaf is transparent. It's almost the leaf is almost invisible. Except for these little patches of green. I think they're called chloroplasts inside every cell of the leaf. A little teeny bit of it's green. So that's what we're seeing. So the leaf actually is not green. The leaf actually is invisible or semi-transparent. Because the rest of the leaf is almost, you have to put dyes and things in it for you in order to see anything out of the telescope. Or sorry, microscope. So there's another interesting issue about Eastern philosophy, Eastern religion, which is a direct inversion of what the modern American thinks. So if the modern American thinks, the leaf is real, and the leaf is green, and the leaf is not invisible, the Eastern philosopher will say, no, that's all actually the opposite of the truth. The truth is the leaf is not real, the leaf is not green, and the leaf is invisible. Okay, now the average person hearing that's going to say, you need to take your Ritalin, you need to take your Prozac, you need to hit the mental ward, you're crazy. I can just see somebody laughing. You're crazy, silly little man with your Buddhist robe on. Oh, but guess what? All you need is a microscope and your local scientist in the biology lab to magnify the leaf, and everything the Eastern philosopher said is verified. Then the egotistical natural person and their little giggling is disproven. Okay, so is that a powerful enough example for you? So, yeah, I mean, science in every way seems to be aligned with, not in every way, sorry. I mean, the cutting edges of science and the basic areas of science seem to be aligned with Eastern philosophy, because science is against this materialism of Western culture, of American culture. Now, that's kind of a mouthful right there, and some of you might not understand what I'm saying. I mean, if you go into your local biology department, say, if I walked over to Purdue University here in West Lafayette, Indiana, started talking to biologists saying, hey, is it true that you're discovering that materialism is false and everything is made of energy and colors don't exist and all this matter stuff all around us is really just invisible and not really even there? And materialism is not true. I mean, a lot of biologists are not going to really know all this stuff. They're going to say, what are you talking about? Because, you know, I mean, they're going to be like, and the average biologist is going to have one little area of research. Say they're studying, you know, blood cells for some leukemia drug big pharma is going to put out or something. So they're not going to know all this stuff. They're going to know everything you ever want to know about blood cells and this certain drug, how it reacts with them. But they're not going to know all these grander, more broad-based general ideas of the big picture. They're going to have the small picture, so they're not going to know. But if you can find the time to put all the ideas that scientists are getting and put them together, you're going to find exactly what I'm saying. This picture of reality that we're discussing here in the show is verified. Okay, it's just that most scientists will study the little teeny piece. You know, like, for example, let's go back to the green leaf. Say the scientist who, you know, studies a leaf, finds out it's green, and most of the rest of the leaf is basically invisible unless you put some dyes in it to see the inner parts of it, the little organelles and so forth inside the plant cell, the leaf cell. They may say, oh, that's pretty interesting, and they may not put together the fact that, gee, that's pretty stunning. The leaf is actually invisible, and it's not really even green. And that verifies all these metaphysical principles that Eastern philosophers have been talking about for, you know, 4,000 years. And a lot of Western religious philosophers have as well. So they won't put it all together. And then you can study other aspects. What about what the quantum physicists are saying? What about what the superconductivity physicists are saying? What about all these people in these new electronics industries that are emerging? They all come to these same conclusions. But most people don't take the time to put all these aspects together, so they don't realize that, yes, science does, our big money science out there even, and the universities and the corporations are verifying this Eastern perspective. Really, it's not Eastern. Really, it's just the perspective of the world religions. What is real is the divine spiritual force that is omnipresent. Just like in the Bible says, God is omnipresent. So that's, and since God is light, Jesus said, I'm the light of the world, and That means that this spiritual light, this ultimate light, is everywhere. It's omnipresent. That is exactly what Buddhism and Hinduism have been saying. What's the difference? Oh, what, do we want to have a war because they think different than us? They don't think different than us. Okay? Now, I don't think religions really cause war. I don't want to get into this issue, but I'm just going to say I've kind of alluded, hinted like, oh, that's as if people are really going to war over religion. Now, that may have happened sometimes, but I hold the position that most wars are economic nature. So please don't anybody email me and say, oh, I don't think wars are caused by religion. Well, neither do I. Okay, it's not an issue I want to get into in this show. It's a side issue, so let's just leave it on the shelf right now. So, basically, now there's some interesting issues talking about this scientific issue. There's some interesting issues that come out of it. It kind of shows us that, amazingly, the natural person is an unscientific buffoon. And the, what you can call the non-natural person, the meditator, the spiritualized person, is scientific. Unbelievable. Let me say this in different words. The materialistic paradigm of the fear and desire state of the natural person is not supported by science or philosophy, even though the average scientist and philosopher doesn't know this. You have to put all of science, quantum mechanics, and everything together, and you know all this stuff about biology and everything. You have to put it all together to see this. Okay, so the non-physical, immaterialist, non-physicalist, immaterialist perspective of the spiritualized, non-natural person, believing that reality is composed of light and energy and matter isn't really there and it's all an illusion and a dream, that is being backed up by science, and therefore that person is scientific. Unbelievable. And the reason it's so unbelievable is because nobody knows this. Where else is anybody talking about this? Anywhere. Okay, I mean, most people don't connect the dots enough to figure all this out and to realize that this is what's going on. That the biologists, when they're studying their leaf and they see that the leaf is see-through, is transparent and basically invisible, unless they put some dyes in it, that's a philosophical issue right there. Okay, what your eyes are seeing is not there. When you see a green leaf, the greenness is not there. It's a dream, an illusion, and all you need to prove that is a microscope. Okay, and then you get the microscope out, and basically you don't see anything except little green dots. The leaf basically isn't there as far as your eyes can tell. Okay, so there are major metaphysical issues here. Yeah, go study molecules. I mean, magnify that leaf a little more, magnify its DNA. Start looking at that molecule, then things really get weird. Materialism pretty much dies right away. And when you get to the level of atoms and subatomic particles, materialism is completely gone. All you have is energy, which doesn't obey any kind of causal relationships, cause and effect, doesn't operate according to any material laws, solidity, time, everything's gone. So that's exactly what Eastern philosophers have been saying all along. Space, time, matter, solidity, motion, all these things are just a dream. So it's just absolutely profound, amazing. And you can have scientists who are studying this stuff every day and they can't put it together. They'll march around saying, oh, we're materialists, when everything in their discoveries is contradicting materialism. Who got this crazy idea of materialism in everybody's head? Why is it so fashionable? Why don't we just throw it away? There's not even any evidence for it, except our ordinary state of consciousness and our egotistical state, which is so unreliable that everything we predict about it will become falsified, such as we'll think that the bullet, when it shoots from the gun, is not moving and is moving at the same time, as we discussed in an earlier example. What? Does that make any sense? That's just completely ridiculous. So these are very profound issues. I'm going to stop this first show on meditation and Eastern philosophy right here, and we'll pick it up next time, probably in a month or so. We'll have part two of this. But there's, needless to say, some of the most profound issues out there are brought up in this discussion of Eastern philosophy. We're talking about the mechanics of ourselves. We're talking about the basis of our being, our existence here. So I don't know what could be more important than that. So hopefully you'll join me next week for the Antimatter Radio Show. Go to antimatterradio.com to check out the archives. Everything about this show is all right there on that website. Take care. Talk to you next week.